says that Yitzchak and Rivka davened for a child. She was in one corner, he in another corner. And the Torah says, Vayetar lo, that God answered him first. So Chazal say, Eino dome tefillah tzadik ben tzadik, tefillah tzadik ben rasha. There's no comparison of the tefillah of a tzadik, who's the son of a tzadik, Yitzchak, whose father was Avram, than a tefillah of a tzadik ben rasha. Rivka's father was Besuel, right? So he was a rasha. So the tefillah of a tzaddik ben tzaddik is better than a tzaddik ben rasha, which in modern day terms, right, the tefillah of an FFB is better than the tefillah of a bal tshuva. Okay. Aside from the fact that I just have to understand that, what that means, there is a what?
Well, but a bal tshuva is on a higher level.
We'll see. One second. The Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, has a responsa, a tshuva, following question. They had two candidates to be the chazan on Rosh Hashanah. One was an exemplary person himself, special, but his lineage wasn't all that great. His parents weren't all that from whatever they were. And the other one had a tremendous yichus, right? He had nice lineage, but he wasn't as great as the first one. So who gets the what's it called, the shteller? Who's the best one to have be the chazan? The one who has better parents, or the one who's better himself? So the Rosh says, what do we care about his parents, right? The ikar over here is what the person is. So you take the person who's better. Now that seems to contradict what we just told you before. Here it says that a tefillah of a tzaddik ben tzaddik, right? Somebody who comes from good lineage is better than the tefillah of somebody who may even be equal or better, but doesn't come from good lineage. So which is it? In the Rosh? I think the simplest answer is over here, the two were equal. The only other factor was what their parents were. Right? But it could be that Yitzchak was also better because he was more of his life. He surely was more frum than Rivka, right? So it's still a similar question. So they ask, here it seems to contradict this idea. Okay. One of the Rebbeim in my yeshiva, Rabbi Aaron Krakotsky, gave a very good answer. It's not the answer I'm going to tell you, but I'll tell you what he said anyway, because I really like it, years ago. He said that it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu mis'ave l'tfilasen shel tzadikim. The Rabban Shalom desires the tefillah of tzaddikim, and therefore he sometimes puts them in situations where they have to daven, because he knows that he's going to give them what they want, but he wants them to think not, so they'll daven for their sake. It elevates them or whatever. So that's why it says that Rivka was an akara. God knew he was going to give her children, but he wanted them to feel the urgency to daven, so they would daven. Therefore, if the idea is that God loves these tefillahs so much, who's going to answer first? The person who is on a lower level, the person on a higher level? Obviously the person on the lower level first. Why? Because his tefillahs are not that desirable. So he'll answer them. The ones that are really desirable, he's going to keep that person going and not answer them so fast, because he wants to hear their tefillahs. So he said that what Chazal say, Eino Dome, Tfilas, Tzadik ben Tzadik, the Tzadik ben Rasha, is just the opposite of what we think. There's no comparison between the Tfilah of a Tzadik ben Tzadik to the Tfilah of a Tzadik ben Rasha, which is superior. And therefore God answered him first to get him out of the way, but didn't answer her because he really desired to hear her Tfilas more. Okay, cute answer. But let me tell you what I really think. That's the following. The halacha is, or it's not a halacha, it says, "B'makom shabali tshuva omdim, afilu tzadik gomer enu yachol lamod." Where a bal tshuva stands is even greater than a tzadik gomer. Right? Somebody who was a tzadik his whole life is not as great as somebody who repented, right, came bal tshuva, is greater than a tzadik who was a tzadik to begin with. Okay, that's what it says. On the other hand, the halacha is like this. You can never bury a tzaddik next to a rasha. Okay? They used to have two different cemeteries. Even today, people in Mechal Shabbos or whatever, we don't bury them in the regular cemetery without separating them from people who are or Shomer Shabbos. But it's more than that. They used to have cemeteries for all different grades of people. And you don't bury a tzaddik next to a chassid. Not chassid in today's vernacular, right? Chassid meaning somebody who went beyond the letter of the law. And tzaddik is somebody who did the letter of the law. You don't bury them together. They have two different areas in the cemetery for tzaddikim and for chassidim. But you are allowed to bury a tzaddik next to a baal tshuva. Which doesn't make sense. I just told you about tshuva is greater than the tzaddik. So if the chassid is greater than the tzaddik and you can't bury a tzaddik next to a chassid, then why can you bury a tzaddik next to a baal tshuva? So in order to answer that, I want to say the following, and then we'll see the answer to the first question we asked. A tzaddik ben tzaddik has a milah. He has something going for him. The fact is that most of his life, right, or a good portion, well, all of his life, he was frum, and he racked up merit. Okay, not only him, his parents too. He was born into it. And from the beginning, he already was fine. So, in totality of merit, he has more merit than somebody who came and was a baal tshuva in his midlife, where half of his life he didn't have all those zechuyos. Right. On the other hand, the baal tshuva has something over the tzaddik. What is that? Since he came to it on his own, and he had more of a test, everything that he does is more significant qualitatively, because he has a past and he remembers what it's like to do the other way, so he has to overcome his yetzer hara more. So every single decision he makes to do what's right is a little bit more difficult than the person who's been in the habit of doing it his whole life. Okay. So his mila is that in any specific time where each of them would have to do the same action, the baal tshuva's action is more qualitative because he has to overcome a negative to do it, a past. On the other hand, if you look at the totality of their lives, right, the tzaddik accumulates more merit quantitatively than the baal tshuva did in over his life. Therefore, the makom shebale tshuva omdim, where baal tshuva stands, if you isolate any moment, the baal tshuva is going to be better than the tzaddik at that moment. Because if they're doing the same thing at that moment, the baal tshuva is going to have a harder time to do it because he has a past, and the tzaddik has an easier time because he's already programmed to do that. But if you look at the totality of their lives, it evens out. Because this one has more quantity and this one has less quantity. So if you're looking at quality at any given moment, the baal tshuva, b'makom shebale tshuva omdim, where they stand, at that moment, they're greater than the tzaddik ben tzaddik. But not in totality. Therefore, you can bury them, right? In fact, I want to say even more cute, b'makom shebale, if they're still standing, then the baal tshuva is bitter. But if they're both dead and buried, they're lying, then you can bury them together. Because it evens out. Each one has a mila that at the end of their life it compensates one for the other. And therefore the idea is the following, I think. When a person's davening for themselves, okay, like over here, Rivka and Yitzchak, so they need zechuyos that they've amassed in the past. So the zechus avos, the merit of their forefathers, right, and the merit of their totality of life, of merit, helps them. So the tefillah of a tzaddik ben tzaddik for themselves is greater than the tefillah of a tzaddik ben rasha for themselves. But when you're talking about somebody to daven for the tzibur has all the merit from the past too. Right? It's merit of the tzibur. So you don't need past zechuyos. What do you need? At that moment, whose tefillahs are stronger? At that moment, the baal tshuva's tefillahs are stronger. So that's what the Rosh said. If you want to know who should daven Rosh Hashanah for the tzibur, right? The tzibur has plenty of merit, going all the way back to Avraham Avinu. They don't need the merit of that chazan's parents. What they need is a superlative tefillah. That's better for the Baal Tshuva. But when somebody's davening for themselves, then we look at their merit. Their merit is stronger if it started from a generation before than if it started just now. That's the difference, I think. Okay, any questions on that? Not, well, yeah.
Does that mean, in essence, that the Shaliach Tzibur, the Rosh Hashanah, it's more adif to be Baal Tshuva?
Again, what?
Would that mean, like, let's say you have two qualified candidates.
Right.
Equal every aspect in voice and age and manner, all the qualifications. Would it be better for Baal Tshuva to take the place of a FFB in the place of on Rosh Hashanah based on what you just said?
Yes and no. It could be if they're equal mamish, then it's a different story. Here they weren't equal exactly. Here this one was better himself, but the other one had better family ties. So he said to the Gavi the Rabban Shalom, his family ties we don't care about because the Tzibur has all his family ties. So there we, who's better is who you give it to. Right? And the fact, yeah.
But why does family lineage is so important when you see in history that you can have a tzaddik and then the next generation is completely terrible? Why is it important? Even today when people look for marriages and spouses, they look at that and judge it.
It may not be irrelevant. It's not for sure something that's foolproof, but it's not irrelevant. I'll tell you why. If you're looking physically, heredity wise, genes, okay? So if you have two healthy parents or whatever that genetically are very good, and you have two others that, what's it called, have some recessive genes or whatever. So if you had to pick, right, ideally, I'd pick the ones, but that's no guarantee. Because it could be that the children will come from a recessive gene from three generations before, right? And even though the parents are nice, strong, healthy, they're going to have that recessive gene and be something negative. But the truth is, if you look over this whole span of time and generations, the chances are that the ones that have more dominant genes right now, it's going to come up in later generations better. Those recessive genes aren't going to come out so much. So you can have people who are tzaddikim, right, and good family lineage, and you could have a rotten apple in one of the, but the chances are that in the next generation or the generation after that, right, it's going to come back to be at least potentially better. So same thing over here spiritually. Okay. Avraham and Yitzchak? Why? No, yeah, okay.
Okay. During their lifetime, they must have been davening for things.
I hear for themselves.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay, according to this rule, the Chora, when they daven for themselves, the Torah says that tzaddik ben tzaddik is better. I hear. Okay, that's that. Next.
Can I
say
When you're saying that Hashem answered Yitzchak first, weren't they davening for the same thing? So I don't really understand what that means.
Right, no, it's one of them had to be answered, okay, or both of them had to be answered. It says that there was a cloud that came and descended on Yitzchak to let him know that that he was answered, right.
Literally answered.
Right. Okay.
What you said before regarding the Hashem wants to tzaddikim.
Right.
Right. You see, how do you explain, sort of explain it? Across the board, it seems to be break down the lineage of Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, all being Akaro.
Except for Leah.
The whole plan?
Some Chazal say that was the reason by all of them, mm-hmm. that the Rav Shem wanted them to daven. Others say that things that come with difficulty, you appreciate more. And you put more effort into,
right.
And that's another reason also. Some say that Rivka didn't get pregnant right away because she got a bracha from her brother, who's a Rasha, and people would say that that the bracha paid off. So first you see the bracha didn't pay off, and then the Rabban Shalom gave her children. Okay. Esav came out hairy, mature, like a little mature little kid. And Yaakov was each time, simple meaning, he was very immature. So the Tozer HaShiva says a very interesting thing.
He was what?
Immature.
Oh.
So he says, the Tzel Zohar Shiva says the following. He says, if you look in secular world at high school boys, they are muscular football players, right? They look like, you know, little barriers, okay? And you look at yeshiva boys in high school, they look like they're 10 years old or whatever. They're little, scrawny little kids. Why? He says that whenever, he says in nature, okay, something that has lesser of a goal matures faster. Insects mature within hours, if not minutes, from when they're born. Okay? Animals don't have to stay with their parents for a long time, right, before they're able to be on their own. The thing that takes the longest time to mature is a human being. A human being needs to be by the parents until he grows up, maybe till 30, 40, whatever. She says, because the greater the goal, the longer it takes to mature towards that goal. That's what you see in nature. It says, therefore, Yaakov had the goal of Olam Haba. He had an otherworldly goal, right? Eternal goal. So he matured very slowly. He came out immature. Esav was all for this world. So this world is very short compared to the next world. So he came out mature. Like animals come out more mature than human beings. He said, that's why yeshiva bachrim, who have greater goals in this world, right, than just to mature, get a job, and, you know, support their family or whatever, but they have goals, spiritual goals beyond that, they mature a lot less faster than their counterparts in the secular or goyish world, who mature faster. It's an interesting idea. Okay. Okay, it says that whatever the reason why Yaakov did what he had to do was justified. Okay, I'm not going to go into that now, why it was justified. But why Rivka sent him in to fool his father, which we'll get to, but he bought the Bechorah from Esav, he deserved that bracha. So they ask, first of all, well, why didn't Rivka just go in and explain to him what happened? Why did you have to fool him? So Pshat Shem Fol Her says a tremendous thing. He says that if Rivka would have gone in and explained to Yitzchak that Esav's a Rasha, and he sold his Bechora to Yaakov, and Yaakov really deserves this bracha, and Esav deserves nothing because he's already disqualified himself from being in the line of the Jewish people. He's out of the picture. Yitzchak would have accepted that, and he would not have blessed Esav, but he never could have blessed Yaakov with the same full heart that he wanted to bless Esav, because he really had his hopes on Esav being the dominant one, the strong one. He thought he was a tzaddik. He was just going to be like a king or whatever. So he had his heart set on blessing Esav. And therefore, to get the bracha that Esav was supposed to get, Yaakov had to make Yitzchak think he was Esav so he'd get the bracha with the same full heart. Because if she was convinced that Esav didn't deserve the bracha, and he'd have to now have plan B. Plan B would not have been with the same full heart as plan A. So in order for Yaakov to get the bracha he deserved, he had to impersonate Esav. Simple ideas, much deeper ideas. In any case, whatever he did, it was just what he did. Okay, even though it seems not like that, but it was the proper thing to do. Therefore, it's difficult to understand. It says that when Esav came in and he found out that Yaakov had taken his bracha, he cried a bitter cry. Zaka gedolo mora. Really bitter cry. And the Rabban Shalom said, because you made Esav cry that bitter cry, your descendant is going to also cry a bitter cry in history, Mordechai. By Mordechai, it says, by Yizak Zaok Gedolo Mor, we found out what Haman intended to destroy the entire Jewish people, he also gave a bitter cry. So Yaakov was punished that in history, one of his descendants would also cry bitterly. So, Lechore doesn't make sense. If what Yaakov did was justified, and he did what he had to do, and he got the bracha legitimately, because if it wasn't legitimate, the bracha wouldn't have had any effect. wouldn't have taken effect. God doesn't want the bracha to take effect. It won't take effect. Obviously, God agreed, and he gave him the bracha. So then what was the problem? You see from here that what a person does may be 100% justified. But if he could have done it a little nicer and not caused somebody pain, then he's responsible for that too. It's not only if you're vindicated and you're justified in what you do, but every detail, right, has to be done in a way that if you could do it in a sweeter way, in a nicer way, and you did it in a way that hurt somebody else, even though you were justified in doing that, but you could have done it a little bit differently and caused less pain to the other person, then you're held responsible for that too. The justice and judgment in this world isn't just nebulous, you know, general. It's in every single detail. And if you could, you do what's right, but you could do it a little bit nicer and not cause somebody pain, you're going to be held responsible for that too. Okay. And in addition to that, it says, Esav came in, and he, what's it called, said to Yitzchak, he found out that Esav took his, Esav came in, he found out Yaakov took his bracha. So he said, what's it called, do you have any brachas left? You must have something, give me a bracha too. And Yitzchak told him, I gave him everything. There's no more brachas left. And then it says that Esav cried. And after he cried, God gave him, Yitzchak gave him a slew of brachas, right, that we're still suffering from today. He gave him a slew of brachas that we're suffering from today because he got those brachas. So the question is, where do those brachas come from? 2 minutes before that, Yitzchak told him there are no more brachas. So you see from here that sometimes if a person wants something enough, right, and you desire something, right, enough, you can create new wellsprings of brachas in the heavens. You can create new, what's it called, potential, if you want it enough. The example to that is a medrash, which we've quoted here for other purposes, but I'll mention it anyway. The medrash says that there was a man who knew nothing, didn't even know Aleph Beis. He was a total boor, ignoramus. And it didn't bother him. And he was making fun of Eliyahu Navi. So Eliyahu Navi said to him, look, you can make all the fun you want of me, it doesn't make a difference. But you know, I'm concerned about you. Because the first question they're going to ask you after 120 years in the heavenly court is, did you learn Torah? And you don't even know the Aleph Beis. Aren't you afraid of that question? He said, no. He said, I have an answer rehearsed already. And they pop the question, I'm going to give my answer and God's going to have to agree with me and usher me straight into Gan Eden. And so Eliyahu says, I'm very curious. Let's make believe. I'll be the Beis and Shemala, you be you. I'll ask you the question, you tell me your answer. Let's see. So Eliyahu says, how can you learn a Torah? You don't even know the Aleph Beis. He says, because I'm dumb. God made me dumb. I have a low IQ. I can't learn. It's not my fault. So God's going to say, you know what? He's right. The guy's dumb. Yeah, I gave him a low IQ. It's not his fault. It's my fault. Let him in. Eliyahu says, it sounds like an interesting answer. Tell me something, though. What do you do for a living? He says, I'm a fisherman. He says, could you describe for me what you have to know to be a fisherman? He says, yeah. First, you have to know how to make a net. So we plant flax, and we spin it into rope, and we make the ropes into nets, and you have to know how to make a net, because if you make the holes too big, the fish will go right through. If you make the holes too small, the fish will see the net. So you have to make them just right, so the fish don't see the net, but they get caught. And then you have to know where to put it. If you put it too deep, it's beneath the fish. If it's too shallow, it's above the fish. You have to know pretty much from the bubbles that are coming up in the water where exactly to put the net. And then we catch the fish and we clean them and we sell them. That's how I make my living. He said, it's interesting. For fishing, right, God gave you brains. And for Aleph Beis, you couldn't learn Aleph Beis. You don't have the brains to learn Aleph Beis. And the man right away realizes that his answer is not going to hold any water. And he begins to cry. And Eliyahu says, don't worry, everybody says the same thing. They think they don't have the power and they're a self-contradiction. So the Kotzker Rebbe asks a very simple question on this medrash. What was the fact? Was the guy dumb or not? If he was really dumb, because that's what he really thought, that he couldn't learn Aleph Beis, then how did he learn how to fish? And if he wasn't really dumb, how did he fool himself into thinking he was? That's his question. The answer, he says, is he really was dumb. He had a low IQ, and he really could not learn how to fish. He was right, 100%. I said, how did he learn how to fish? He said, sometimes when people know that it's do or die, you go beyond your potential. People who can't lift, 50 pounds under normal circumstances, when they're in an earthquake and a wall falls on them, which weighs hundreds of pounds, and they know that if they don't do something, that's it. People have been known with their adrenaline, right, to push a 200-pound wall off of them because they know that it's do or die. People who could never learn how to swim. They fell overboard, they learned fast, or they never learned anything after that. So sometimes the situation of the extreme situation of necessity gives you potential that is beyond what you normally have. That's what the Kutzker Rebbe said. He looked at Parnassa as do or die. If I don't learn how to fish, I don't eat. I don't eat, I die. So he amassed the ability to learn how to fish, even though normally he wouldn't have been able to do it. Had he looked at Torah the same way, that Torah is life, and if I don't learn Torah, it's like I'm dead, then he would have learned Torah too. But Torah, he didn't feel was a necessity, and therefore he remained with his regular potential, and he didn't learn it. He thought it was dumb. So the same thing over here with Esav. As long as Esav didn't want those brachas so desperately, there were no brachas in heaven for him. But once he had that desperate desire for them, he cried for them. New potential already was created. With that, you can understand the next medrash. The medrash says that Esav cried two tears, and almost a third. He cried one tear from his right eye, and that caused the destruction of the first temple. He cried a tear with his left eye, and that caused a destruction of the second temple. And a third tear welled up in his eye, and had it fallen, we'd never have a third temple. That's what the Midrash says. Meaning the following. If Asa could want those brachas so much to cry for them, right? And when we have those brachas, and we don't appreciate them, and we abrogate them, it's a tremendous condemnation of us. So Esav's tears said, I gave you the brachas. Here's a guy who cried for not having them, right? Two tears. And when you come to a situation where you don't appreciate those brachas, then that's a tremendous condemnation. It caused one destruction and two destruction, and Esav didn't appreciate them enough to cry a third tear, so it's not that condemning for a third Beis HaMikdash. But it had, there wouldn't be a third Beis HaMikdash either if we came to a situation where we didn't deserve it even. Okay. That's that. Another small thing. It says, Rivka tells Yaakov, Esav wants to kill you for what you did to him. I want you to get out of here. Okay, run to my brother, Lavan, and stay there until Esav forgets what happened. Okay. Now, do you ever think that Esav would have forgotten what happened? What was she talking about? Was she totally, out of touch with reality? Right? Esav, right, wanted those brachas. It was something that affected his whole life. He's ever going to forget? He wake up one morning and says, hey, I don't remember. Why in the world didn't I like my brother Yaakov? What happened? Right? How could he ever forget it? So I heard once, very nice idea. Forgetting does not necessarily mean you don't remember the facts. But it means that you relegate it to the back of your mind and it doesn't make an impression. Sometimes you know something, but it's like filed away. That's called forgetting. Even though you didn't forget the thing itself. But for all practical purposes, you don't act upon it. It doesn't make any impression on you. She said, someday, Esau's going to get so involved in all the other things in his life, this is going to be filed away. The fact to remember, but it's not going to lead him to kill you anymore. It's not going to make an impression on you. I think that's how the Rabban Shalom remembers or forgets. In Rosh Hashanah, say, God never forgets. So what is the idea of remembering us? Now the idea is there's certain things the Rabban Shalom knows, but he doesn't act upon them, right? And there's certain things that are born from those, and he does act. What he acts upon is called remembering. And what he doesn't act upon is called forgetting. So we ask the Rebbe, don't forget us. Remember us and treat us, right, in a way that what we do is significant and that you're acting upon it, not ignoring it. That's the idea of remembering and forgetting.
Or we're asking him to forget us, to get kafara on Kippur.
Right, and don't write. But you can't forget it completely, right?
He forgets.
Right. Okay, what else is here? Too long. Okay, it says that Ekev Asher Shoma Avram Bekoli, Avram Avinu kept all the mitzvahs, it says, before they were given. Okay. So first they asked if he kept all the mitzvahs before they were given, from when he was a youngster. So then why didn't he perform the mitzvah Bris Milah before he was 100? So they say various answers. We spoke about this, I think, a few weeks ago. One answer is that you can only do Bris Milah once. It's better to do it when you're commanded than when you're not. So if a mitzvah that he could only do once, he waited till he was commanded. But all the other mitzvahs, he wasn't going to be commanded, and he could do them over and over again. So he did them, even voluntarily. Question is, how did he know? Where did he know this Torah from? How did the Avos know the Torah to be able to keep it voluntarily? Okay. So some say that the Torah was given to Adam HaRishon, but not to be mandatory for him to keep it, but to know what it was. He knew, and he passed it on to his generations. It says Noah learned Torah, and he knew which animals were kosher and which animals were not. That means that there must have been some Torah that already existed, even though it wasn't yet mandatory to keep it. So that's one way. They got it in a, what's it called, in a tradition from Adam HaRishon, that the Torah was handed over traditionally, right, even though it wasn't meant to be kept yet. So that's one way that they say. Another possibility is the following. It says that all the mitzvahs are really connected one to the other, and they're all contained in the Anochi Hashem Lokecha, that I'm the Lord your God, the belief, and all of that is contained in the little dot of the Aleph. What does that mean? Right? All the mitzvahs are just an expression of God's will. There's one, we spoke about this many times, there's one all-encompassing will of God that applies to everything in life, everything in the world, everything in the universe. And it's one all-encompassing thing, because God is one, His will is one. Except we can't relate to that. So God gave us mitzvahs, which are like little windows to that one, unified will of God. I always like to compare it. If you have a gigantic light bulb that's so bright and so big that you can't look at it, you enclose it in a globe, and in the globe you cut 613 little windows. Each window you see a small portion of the light bulb. There's only one light bulb. But if you look through all 613 windows, you'll know what the light bulb looks like. You got a composite picture of the light bulb. So those are mitzvahs. So somebody who can see that all-encompassing will of God can deduce what the mitzvahs are. Right? He can work backwards. Right? Because he can see that from this vantage point, I see this mitzvah, from this vantage point, whatever. The Avos were so great, but they didn't have to see the all-encompassing will of God through mitzvahs. They were able to see the mitzvahs through that, by understanding the all-encompassing will of God. Right, but there they probably learned the seven mitzvahs of Noah. So Avram, from the seven mitzvahs of Noah, from those seven windows, he was able to see what God's entire will was and understand the other mitzvahs. Others say, since the Torah is the blueprint of the world, God created the world, is a physical manifestation of the Torah. Right? We normally think that because there's grain growing outside, that's why there's mitzvahs of Meiser and Truma, whatever. But the opposite is true. Because God wanted a mitzvah of Meiser and Truma, He made grain to fit the Torah. The Torah is God's plan. It's the blueprint. And from that blueprint, He made the world. So a good architect, if you show him the house, he'll tell you what the blueprint looked like. And if you give a good architect, he can look at the blueprint and tell you exactly what the house is going to look like. So great Talmidei Chachamim can look in the Torah and know what the world's all about. They say the Chazon Ish, right, had a tremendous grasp of medical knowledge. And he never went to medical school, never opened a medical book in his life. Where did he have it from? He had it from Torah. Same story, the two people, a couple from Baltimore, came to him. Their son was going to have a brain operation, and they wanted a bracha. So they flew to Eretz Yisrael. This is years and years, time of the Chazon Ish, in the 50s, the late 40s. Special, they made a, what's it called, a special trip to Eretz Yisrael. They came back boat, I don't know, and they asked for a bracha. Chazon Ish asked them to describe what the operation was going to be like, or whatever, what the problem was. And he took out an envelope and scrawled something on the opposite side of the envelope. He said, before the operation, when you get back to America, give this to the surgeon who's going to do the operation. So they thought it was some kind of amulet or whatever that they wanted him to hold in his pocket, that should be a, you know, a skula to the operation should go okay. So they got back, they gave the envelope. Says, this old rabbi in Israel gave us this amulet. Could you please take it into the operation? The doctor looks at it and he says, this isn't from some old rabbi in Israel, this is from a surgeon. This is a description of the operation that I, or what's it called, developed. But I see that this doctor has a little twist, right, to do it a little bit better, a little bit safer. And I'm very impressed, right? So who is this doctor? He says, not a doctor, it's an old rabbi, right? And it's an amulet. It's not a disgrace. So, no, it's not. This is the way we surgeons diagram an operation. And he said, you don't have to be embarrassed that you asked a second opinion. I don't care. I'd just like to know who this doctor is, because obviously he's been working on this kind of operation like me, and he's gotten to a twist that I didn't think of, and I'd really like to meet him. They said, he's really an old rabbi in Israel. He went, they said, to meet the Chazon Ish, and became a Baal Tshuva because of that. So where did the Chazon Ish know that from? Because he learned from the Torah. Again, if you're a good architect, you can look at the blueprint and know what the house looks like. So he looked in the Torah and he understood the world. But if you're a good architect, you can also look at the house and know what the blueprint looks like. So the Avos looked at the world and they deduced backwards the Torah. That's where they learned Torah from.